Prior to America's War of Independence, it started about 241 years ago, there was a lot of political strife in America. Some American colonists were called loyalists. They wanted the colonies to remain loyal to the British monarchy. Some American colonists were independence-minded, and they desired to separate from Great Britain. And then still other colonists were ambivalent. They didn't have strong feelings one way or the other. Well, with different political views strongly expressed, 1775 was a year of tumult in early America. Only 1 year later, the United States would declare issue its Declaration of Independence, and by that document, the newly minted United States of America ceased to be the colonies of Great Britain. 5 years of war would follow from 1776 to 1781. In September 1775, before the war started, and again 12 years later in September of 1887, a founding father by the name of John Witherspoon preached a sermon to the senior class at Princeton University. Witherspoon's sermon was entitled Christian Magnanimity. Well, July 4th, 1776 is considered the birthday of America. 1787, a little over a decade later, was also a critical year in America because 1787 was the year that the new United States Constitution was drafted. And again, there were people who supported the Constitution, and there were people who opposed the ratification of the Constitution, and then there were some people who didn't have strong feelings either way. And these two times of early American history, and this time of national unrest and tumult from 1775 and 1887, Mr. Witherspoon thought it important to address the subject of Christian magnanimity. And even after all these years, Mr. Witherspoon's sermon outline can be found online. It's available for us to read. Of course, today's sermon, you might imagine, is entitled The Art of Magnanimity. Now, magnanimity is a big word. It's one of those $5 words. It's hard to spell. I had to look it up myself. Wasn't even sure how to pronounce it. Magnanimity is M-A-G, and then na, N-A, and then nim, N-I-M, and then I-T-Y. So magnanimity. Well, what is Christian magnanimity? Witherspoon thought it was important. Well, it is an old-fashioned word, five-syllable word, and it's based on the word magnanimous. Our modern Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines magnanimity, and here's the quote, loftiness of spirit, enabling one to bear trouble calmly, to disdain meanness and pettiness, and to display a noble generosity. Well, in our home, we have a number of old, even some big dictionaries, because the meanings of words can change over time. Witherspoon, in his sermon over 200 years ago, gave five definitions to magnanimity. First of all, he said it was to attempt great and difficult things. And I'll go over these so you don't have to worry about writing them at the moment. To aspire after great and valuable possessions. To encounter dangers with resolution. To struggle against difficulties with perseverance. And the fifth, to bear sufferings with fortitude and patience. Well, it's this fifth definition that's the closest definition to magnanimity that we commonly use today. Well, this word magnanimity is quite a mouthful, but the meaning of the word followed by the practice of its principles demonstrates what kind of Christians we are. So those five definitions we'll be using for our 5 points today. And the first point or first definition of magnanimity is to attempt great and difficult things. Do we attempt great and difficult things? Well, how we define great and how we define difficult may be different for each person. For some people, just getting out of bed in the morning, finding their way to the bathroom without assistance is both great and difficult. I recall having that problem when I had some inflamed muscles in my lower back. It took many minutes just to figure out how I was going to slip out of bed and then how I would find my way or wobble my way to a restroom. And then I found myself being very, very careful how I got in and out of the car. That was my idea of great and difficult at that time. Fortunately, that problem was resolved. But what about a feat that others would consider really great and difficult? Do we try great and difficult things? When Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt and across the desert to the Promised Land, and before entering the Promised Land, he sent 12 spies to check out the land of Canaan. He said, I want leaders from each tribe. And God had promised that land to Abraham and his descendants, the Israelites. We can look in Numbers 13 to pick up the story. In Numbers 13, starting in verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. Notice the instructions were, just pick them at random and send out some wimpy doodle and see what happens. No, he wanted somebody who had leadership capacity in each of the 12 tribes. So of the 12, they went out and they surveyed the land of Canaan, the land, the promised land. And two of them brought back a report, and we read in Numbers 13:30. And two of them brought back a report that they were eager to go into the land of Canaan and possess the land, to claim the promise, to claim their inheritance. In Numbers 13:30, then Caleb quieted the people before him, before Moses, and said, let us go up once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. He was ready. He was said, let's do it. He didn't see the obstacles. He saw the opportunity. It may be great and it may be difficult, but Joshua and Caleb were ready. We read the next verse about what the other 10 of the 12 spies reported in Numbers 13, verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, who came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so were we in their sight. Well, that's quite a report. Very different from the two spies compared to the other 10. Well, possessing the land of Canaan, the promised land, was seen as a great and difficult task. And unfortunately, 10 of the 12 spies, who were representatives of the whole of Israel, were not up to the task. They were unwilling to tackle this great and seemingly difficult thing. Do we refuse great and difficult tasks because they seem impossible to us? Well, as a result of the unwillingness of those spies and the people that listened to them to attempt this great and difficult thing, to claim the inheritance that God had promised to Israel, except for the two spies who gave a good report, all of the adults, 20 years age and over, died in the wilderness. They never made it to the promised land. That's referenced in Numbers 14, verses 29 through 35. I'll just reference it and not read through it. It was the next generation that was willing to take up the great and seemingly difficult challenge of conquering the land of Canaan. And of course, we know the story. It's recorded in the book of Joshua, how Joshua then led the Israelites to enter the promised land to secure it. We have the story in chapter 6 of the book of Joshua, in the book of 6 of the book of Judges, after Israelites were already in the promised land, they were living there. And we have the example in Judges 6 of the example of Gideon, who God raised up as a judge to defend Israel from attacks by the Midianites, the Amalekites, and others. And yet Gideon was personally concerned. He wasn't up to this great and difficult task. He didn't think he was able to lead Israel to save them from oppression and destruction from the Midianites and the Amalekites. So let's look in Judges 6, starting in verse 15. So he, meaning Gideon, said to him, O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, one of the tribes of Israel, and I am the least in my father's house. He had the saying, "Hey, I come from a weak tribe. My father's house. I'm not. I don't have any say really in what goes on." Well, is that what we think? Even though God has called us, He has especially selected us. Do we think that we're unworthy? We're not up to the task? Do we come from what we see as a weak family? Are we the least or the lowliest person in that family? Well, when we read in the book of Judges, we find that God indeed used Gideon despite Gideon's uncertainties. We're in Judges 6. Let's go to verse 25. "Now it came to pass the same night the Lord had said to him, 'Take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has.'" So here's an Israelite that has a statue or an idol to Baal. Baal worship in Israel. And what did we hear in the sermonette about don't adopt those pagan worships once you go into this land? This is precisely what some of them were doing. They were adopting Baal worship. And what was the instruction then continuing on to Gideon? "Tear down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the wooden image that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down." Pretty strong instructions. Cut down the image, sacrifice on it. Verse 27, "So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants." Now, this was a weak family, and yet they had numerous servants. "And as did as the Lord had said to him, but because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night." Didn't want anybody to see him. Thought he would get into too much trouble. He was pretty concerned. After all, he didn't have particularly big status in the family. Well, when we read on in Judges 6, we find that Gideon was not punished by tearing it down, the image of Baal. Gideon offered the sacrifice using the wood of that torn down image, and then before Gideon's eyes, the rock upon which the offering was made burst into flames and consumed the offering. And still, you'd think after seeing this then that Gideon would be prepared then to follow God's instructions, further instructions about rising up to be a judge and a savior, as it were, of Israel. Gideon still lacked the courage to follow God's instructions without additional convincing. So we read in Judges in chapter 6, verse 36. "So Gideon said to God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand, as you've said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there's dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you've said.'" Now, it was foggy this morning, and it was a lot of dew out. So if we imagine that we put a piece of rug or a fleece out, what's the chances of that fleece only being wet and all the ground dry? Well, what's the next verse? "And so it was." Well, that's what happened. "When he," meaning Gideon, "rose early the next morning and he squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water." Well, that should be convincing, right? Would that pretty well wrap things for you? Would you be convinced? Not Gideon. "Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on the ground let there be dew.'" So let's flip it around. Let's put the fleece out on the threshing floor. And this time, the fleece will be dry and everything else will be wet. And verse 40, "And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece, but only, but there was dew on the ground." You know, I would take a lot of boldness to ask God, but this time you could tell Gideon was still pretty uncertain. And then Gideon was tasked with the job of rounding up an army to free the Israelites. What the Midianites and Amalekites and others were doing is that whenever the Israelites would plant a crop, they would come over and destroy the crop. They would raid the livestock, kill the livestock, take their donkeys or their horses, take them away. And, of course, what happens when you kill your food supply? The people starve. It's a terrible situation. And that was happening. And so Gideon called for people to recruit an army. And in Judges 7, we read then that what God said about this particular army, because there were too many of them. God didn't need that many. In Judges 7, verse 2, and the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" So if you have just all of those thousands and thousands of soldiers, they'll say, "Well, we did it. We just gathered together. It wasn't God that did it." And so God is teaching lessons every step of the way here to Gideon. And he didn't want people to say, "Well, we did it ourselves. We didn't need God. It was just happenstance that you said God told us to do this." So we read on in Judges 7 how the numbers were reduced. And many of us are familiar with the story about how the army the people were reduced by deciding which ones. First of all, he said, "Send home anybody who is afraid." Well, there went thousands of them went home. Well, who wouldn't be afraid? Because if you were injured in battle, what happened to you? They didn't have antibiotics. They didn't have surgery, modern-day surgery. If you were injured in battle, it was likely a death sentence. A lot of people are afraid of quick death, or a slow death in that case, either way. And so they weeded down by saying, "Well, just let them drink water, and those that drink, you know, like a horse, you know, put their mouth down in the water, those can go home. But those that lift the water to their mouth, keep those." Those are the alert ones who are watching all around. And so we can read that as we go through the book of Judges. And so this first point, to attempt great and difficult things, meaning to have a worthy goal. For Gideon, he had the worthy goal, and he did attempt great and difficult things, however challenging that it was. So we would say, well, do we have a worthy goal, and do we attempt great and difficult things? Or do we run away because it's too hard, or we have to have the wet fleece and the dry ground, or the dry fleece and the wet ground and so forth, and all of the other conditions before we'll step forward. So point one under the definition of magnanimity, to attempt great and difficult things. Second point that Mr. Witherspoon spoke of was to aspire after great and valuable possessions. That was another definition of magnanimity, to aspire after great and valuable possessions. Well, that sounds pretty worldly on the face of it, doesn't it? But see what we can come of this. Because this is really an interesting definition of magnanimity. Is there something that you particularly prize or value? Well, from time to time, my wife and I stumble across some good find, maybe at a garage sale. Now, she goes to far more than I do when she gets a chance, which tells you how few I go to, because she doesn't go to very many. But every once in a while, you get this really, really whatever it is, some precious thing. And when she goes, she'll bring home tools. She says, "I don't know what this does, but can you use this?" "Oh, yes, yes, yes." "Yeah, something wonderful." "Yeah, it looked like it was important." And so maybe you've also sought or maybe stumbled across something that you now cherish, some valuable item. Fill in the blank. If only I could find blank, you know, something valuable to you. As a 12-year-old boy, growing up on the farm, I accompanied my father to an auction sale in February in Minnesota. Yes, it was cold then. I grew up on my parents' dairy farm. And there was a flyer that we got in the mail. There was an emergency dairy cattle auction that was being held then in the coldest month of the year. Apparently, the owner of the dairy herd had just died, and the cattle had to be sold quickly. The neighbors were doing the chores and milking the cows, so they had a quick sale. And so within the week, they sent out flyers to people who might be interested. Well, some people remember baseball statistics. Maybe you're one of those. Some people can name a tune or a song just by hearing one or two bars. Maybe you're one of those. Some people can instinctively remember directions. You turn by the little red wagon that's painted blue, and you go past the house that's torn down, and then you go, and so forth, and by the time you, and you get there to where you're going. Well, for some reason, by the age of 12, I was able to remember pedigrees of dairy cattle. And filed away in my head at that early age, which was a strong interest, was the lineage of purebred brown Swiss dairy cattle. I could tell you the sires and the dams of many famous cattle, certainly all the cattle on the home farm. I could remember the statistics of the pounds of milk produced each year and the pounds of butter fat and what the averaged animal was for each particular sire who had a bull had daughters that produced this well compared to daughters of another bull. And so this was all very interesting to me. And at that particular auction, my father and I noted that there were three cows that had particularly good pedigrees. Well, I went with my father to that auction sale. Apparently, I had skipped school that day. It was pretty exciting. And I'm just thinking now, hey, wait a minute, I'm a teacher. You can't do that. You can't just leave in the middle of the day. Just time has just started to connect here. And he paid the highest prices for the three most expensive cows in the sale. $335 for one, $365 for one, and $395 for the other. I can tell you their names and their backgrounds, too. Because I'm just slightly over 12 now, but years old. It was a freezing cold day, and we didn't have a truck to haul these cows home. And it was about 40 miles away. My father called up a trucker. The trucker wasn't too happy that he'd have to get out of his warm, cozy chair, shut off his television, get in a truck. And just to be sure, of course, that my father got the right cows, my father trusted me as a 12-year-old kid to ride along with the trucker because I could identify the correct cows. After all, most people, they looked at brown Swiss cattle. They're all brown. They all look alike. So he wanted to make sure you get the right ones home. Well, my reading of the pedigrees was accurate. Two of those cows went on to become two of the highest-ranked cows in the brown Swiss breed in the United States. And they went on to become ancestors to two world-ranked bulls, meaning whose daughters produced or had special characteristics. And so what my father and I saw on that super cold day was a potential for greatness, and we made great efforts to obtain those cows. Now, that was in that industry at that time. It was something that we recognized. You would have never thought so. I still remember the scungy-looking barn. It was cold. The cattle had long hair coats on them. You would not have imagined it, that there would be something great that would come out of that. We have some biblical examples of aspiring for a great or a valuable possessions. And if we turn to Matthew 13, verse 44 and 45. In Matthew 13, verses 44 and 45. What's great and valuable is Jesus Christ was telling about the kingdom of heaven. And he said, it's like treasure hidden in a field in which a man found and hid, and for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys the field. The treasure was there. He had to recognize the value of it. It didn't have value to whoever had the field, but it had value to the person who found it. So the kingdom of heaven had value to the finder, the one who found it. In the next verse, Matthew 13, verse 45, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who, when he found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Notice, he's a merchant. He made it his business to understand what he was looking for. In some cases, like in the treasure in the field, sometimes somebody just stumbles across something. Whoa, and you become aware of it. And I guess that happened to me in my early life with regard to church. I wasn't necessarily seeking it out. I stumbled across it and said, you know, this is something worthwhile. This is worth it. This is a great treasure to me. And others search out to try to find the truth, as in this merchant seeking beautiful pearls. Well, a merchant has his business. He knows his pearls. And if you're in the pearl business, there's lots of different qualities and grades of pearl. I remember being at the Mikimoto Pearl Place in Japan, the oyster beds, and I would watch them underground. You go down in an elevator and you go underground. They have this big glass, like you would see at SeaWorld, where you see animals or swimming under the water. Well, they had oyster beds there that they were growing the pearls in, and then young ladies would take and slather themselves all over with some kind of grease. And then you would watch as they would dive down to the deeper than the depth of this room, you know, down 1.5 stories, and they would stay down there for about 10 minutes. How they could hold their breath, I don't know. But it was cold water. It's oceanic water. But they were slathered up with grease to retain their body heat in them and held their breath. And they would be picking through looking for the pearls. They were looking for whatever pearls were looking to be harvested, if they were the right size or the right color or whatever. So a merchant seeking pearls would recognize something that was of great value, of great price. And that merchant went and sold all that he had and bought it. Well, what's the greatest, most valuable possession that you could own? In 1 Corinthians 9:27, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Corinth. He said, "Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things." They're careful, in other words. "And now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown." In other words, if you're so careful to obtain something that will fade and die or rust or mold or go down in value, he said, what we have, what's most precious to us, is imperishable. It's the crown we heard about in a recent sermon. That imperishable crown, it won't go away. It won't go down in value. And so what did he say to do about it? And he wrote that to a letter to the Philippians in chapter 3, verse 14, of Philippians 3:14. So this prize, this imperishable crown, Paul writes, "I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." So we're getting closer to this understanding. It's an imperishable crown. It will never go away. And it's this great prize. It's a goal. It's an upward call. It's not something that's bad for us. It's something that we have to rise to. And it requires our acceptance of Jesus Christ. Let's move on to what Jesus Christ said in Matthew 19, verse 29. What's the value of this special prize? In Matthew 19:29, "And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake," meaning Christ, for the sake of following Christ, "shall receive a hundredfold," in other words, many times over, and then what? "And inherit eternal life." That sounds like an imperishable crown. We move on to Matthew 25, verse 34. In Matthew 25, verse 34, "Then the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.'" So we look around at this world around us, this great possession, and we think the kingdom of God that we aspire to is not recognized as valuable by others. 10 of the 12 spies sent by Moses were afraid to seek the prize of the promised land. And despite the tribulations and slavery, and despite the miracles of their escape from Egypt, the Israelites even wanted to go back there. And then we think of Gideon. He needed a series of miracles for him to step forward and lead the people of Israel to throw off the yoke of the oppression from Midianites and Amalekites. Are we willing to step forward and follow God, to recognize the promised land, the kingdom of God that's before us? Are we willing to rise up and throw off the oppressor, the Satan, the devil, who would work to prevent us from living fulfilled lives? Are we willing to put our faith and trust in God for what he has in store for us, that great prize, the kingdom of God? And of course, we can turn to that scripture in Revelation 21, verse 7. Who does that prize go to? that we strive for, that great worthy goal, in Revelation 21, verse 7, "He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." So, the second definition of magnanimity is to aspire after great and valuable possessions, meaning to have a worthy goal. The third point that Mr. Witherspoon brought out was to encounter dangers with resolution. To encounter dangers with resolution. Well, this behavioral characteristic of encountering dangers with resolution is particularly challenging. How many of us can say that we encounter danger with resolution? We know the story of Jonah, who ran away when he was called upon by God to do a great task. He didn't look out for the first point in this sermon. He didn't take on that great and difficult task. He ran away. And the book of Jonah tells us how he fled. He went in the opposite direction from Nineveh. Jonah got on a ship, sailed across the Mediterranean Sea, and after he was considerable ways away, the sea became rough. The sailors feared for their lives. So what's the first thing they did? Well, what do you do to lighten the load? They threw their cargo overboard. And we can read this in Jonah, in the book of Jonah, in chapter 1, verses 7 through 16. And I'm just going to paraphrase this story, because the sailors were determined, first of all, to save their own lives. That's pretty important. What do they say? The first law of nature is self-preservation. True for plants and true for animals. People want to preserve themselves. So the sailors said, they chucked the freight overboard. And then, if we read through it, they says, well, everybody prayed to their gods, and the captain found Jonah sleeping. Hey, man, what are you doing sleeping here? Get up and pray to your God, and I'm afraid we're all going to die. And Jonah said, I'm afraid it's my fault. You know, Jonah knew. Jonah was guilty, and he knew it. And he said, if you throw me off the ship, the sea will become calm, and you'll be okay. Well, they couldn't believe it. The shipmen didn't believe it, and they said they rowed hard. They just didn't say, well, we'll just try to tough it out the way it is. They rowed hard, but they made no progress. And finally, they asked for forgiveness, if we read through this, and they said, we don't want to throw Jonah overboard. But as a last resort, at Jonah's insistence, they threw him over. And the sailors, of course, and the sea was immediately calmed. The sailors were remarkably resolute in this disaster. They didn't throw Jonah over at the first suggestion that he's a problem. The first came first. First, we throw over the surplus cargo. I'm sure they threw over some of the heaviest stuff first, and then they threw over the rest of it. And then they said, okay, we're going to have to get serious here. Everybody has a God. You better pray to him. They woke up Jonah. Better pray to your God. In other words, there was a whole series of steps they were going through. And even when Jonah said, it's me, guys. Just, you're going to have, I'm guilty. I'm not worthy. Throw me overboard. Now, I don't, you know, how many of us say, you know, God, I'm guilty. I guess you'll just have to throw me overboard. It's not very pleasant over there in a churning sea. And there's things under there, too, that like to eat people, and they don't do it all at once. And yet, when the sea was calm, the sailors were safe. It's interesting. What did they do? They were grateful to God, and they offered a sacrifice. They made their way to shore and did that. Well, how do we approach problems? Do we panic? Or do we remain calm and methodically seek a solution? After all, that's what Mr. Witherspoon says was the definition of magnanimity, was being resolute, having a step-by-step approach to seeking a solution. Of course, many of us remember the story of Daniel. The prophet Daniel was a prince of Israel who was captured and carried away to a foreign land. Daniel became a palace servant for the king Nebuchadnezzar, the king in Babylon. But young Daniel was faced with a problem of how to avoid eating things that were apparently unclean. And Daniel approached the subject with calm resolve and a request, and he offered a bargain or a deal to his supervisor. You might say that Daniel offered his supervisor a sporting proposition. And in Daniel 1, verse 8, we can read Daniel 1, 8, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he," meaning Daniel, "asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself." And he was making a bargain. He says, you know, give it 10 days and we'll see who's healthier. You know, the guys that eat the stuff that you're giving them or those of us that want to eat whole foods. And as we read on, Daniel was successful in his carefully planned request. Well, do we have firm goals? And when we encounter a difficult or dangerous obstacle along the way, do we approach those obstacles with a calm mind, methodical decision-making process, and a firm resolve? Do we follow the examples of the sailors who were transporting Jonah? Do we follow the strategy employed by Daniel? So the third point is a definition of magnanimity, is to encounter dangers with resolution. To encounter dangers with resolution. The fourth definition of magnanimity that Mr. Witherspoon pulled out was to struggle against difficulties with perseverance. There's another one of those four or five syllable words. And this one I could shorten to sticking to your goal. To struggle against difficulties with perseverance. One of the most remarkable examples in the Bible of someone sticking to his goal, displaying perseverance, is where we read in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, the story of Noah. Noah was given a huge task, a gargantuan task, and Noah stuck to that task through to completion, even though it took 100 years to build the ark. Now, I've been given some big tasks. None of them have taken 100 years. I thought they were big tasks if it took more than an hour or whatever, or two or three, or maybe on the farm you got through in a season, and that was a big task. Noah had a 100-year task. But I want to move to Luke 19, and I want to reference the parable of the minas. The parable of the minas in Luke 19, I'm going to just paraphrase it here. Now, mina is a unit of currency, and I find different definitions of the value of this little mina, of this coin. One of them says it's, one source says it's 1/16 of a talent. Well, what's a talent? Well, a talent, one source says it's 75 pounds of gold was a talent. So a 16th of that would be 1 1/4 pounds of gold, or 20 ounces. And 10 servants in Luke 19 were each given one mina and were told to be responsible for it. Well, that's 10 servants, 10 minas, and see what you can do with it. And the master went away. And then as we read, as the master came back after the year, and then he asked for a report from those 10 servants. And they did a varying amount. Some of them did better than others. And in Luke 19, verse 17, the master said to one servant who had gotten 10 for the one. He had taken one mina and produced 10. And the master says, "Well done, good servant. Because you were faithful in very little, you now have authority over 10 cities." Faithful in very little. Well, very little, let's see, 20 ounces of gold at $1,183.66 an ounce as of yesterday is $23,673.20. So if somebody gave you $23,673, would you supply them nearly $250,000 one year from now? You'd say, good job there, Charlie Brown, right? Good job by making 10 times of what you were originally given. And others didn't all do that. They performed at a lesser rate. Some of them did five minas for the one, and some just did the one, didn't invest it at all, just buried it. My economics students are playing a virtual reality game right now as we for this during this month. And they buy and sell stocks at real stock market prices on the stock market, at the beginning of this five-week period, I give each of the students an imaginary $1 million. And they have to invest it. And they invest this $1 million and they buy and they sell stocks as often as they want. And they track their investments for a little over a month, for 5 weeks. And at the end of that time, we see how much would they have made or lost if it was real money. It's all done in what they call the virtual or imaginary world. And some students do quite well. I don't have the results in for this fall yet, but last year, one of my students used his virtual or imaginary $1 million, and in 5 weeks, he made an additional $750,000 playing the real stock market, as you can do it on the computer every day, and did well. Well, after he discovered that, he had a new lease on life. His family put together all of the money they could scrape up, that this young man, who was a high school senior at the time, could manage all of their investments. Well, he's a college student now, decided to change his major to business and economics. And he's one of the unusual ones. Now, most students don't make a lot of money, but he was good at it. Most students lose substantial amounts of money, and they're hoping and begging and praying that they will be able to produce the $1 million back at the end of the 5 weeks. It's challenging to remain true to your goals and maximize your investment opportunities without panicking. Persevering, because people, they would panic. Oh, the market is down, then they would sell when the market was down without waiting an additional day or two or three. So they would buy high and sell low instead of buying low and selling high. And this, they weren't patient, they weren't persevering, they weren't looking at the bigger picture, at the longer picture. Perseverance, because of faithfulness, is a responsibility is rewarded. In James chapter 5 and verse 11. In James 5 verse 11. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You've heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. And so we have here noting the perseverance of Job, that despite the struggles and despite the difficulties, that he stuck to it, his belief in God, ultimately then persevered against his difficulties. So point four was the definition of magnanimity, to struggle against difficulties with perseverance, or also called sticking to your goal. The fifth point, or definition of magnanimity, is the one that we're most familiar with. To struggle against difficulties with to bear sufferings with fortitude and patience. To bear sufferings with fortitude and patience. I would say that's the most common definition we use today. My parents had 4 sons in 5 years. And being a parent requires a great deal of patience. And after I became a parent with several children, I realized that my brothers and I had to have been an extreme challenge for my parents to rear. Frankly, I don't really know how they did it. At age 5, growing up on the farm, I recall my father taking me out of the house and over to the machinery shed. He said, "Come on, son, I need help to fix the plow." I protested, saying, "I don't know how to help him fix the plow." My dad calmly explained that it was my job to simply stand there, and if anything went wrong, then he would have someone to holler at. So I stood next to the plow, standing there stiff and straight, watching my father make the repairs, and I waited quietly and a little bit fearfully, hoping that nothing would go wrong. I wanted to be ready in case my dad needed somebody to holler at. Because, you know, you never know about fixing a plow. I had no experience in this matter. My dad wasn't the kind of guy who hollered at anything if it went wrong. But I knew I had a big job ahead of me, just in case there was a problem. And I waited, and I waited. And when you're a little kid, minutes seem like hours. And for all of my waiting and all of my readiness, standing there stiff, ready to be hollered at, nothing went wrong. And it was only as an adult, and I became a parent myself, that I realized why my dad took me, a little 5-year-old boy, out of the house. My mother must have been at her wit's end with too many little boys getting into too much trouble. and just removing one child from the house changed the dynamic in the house. It was an opportunity for my dad to demonstrate patience with me, and it was an opportunity for me to learn patience by watching my dad fix the plow. The Bible records an example of a father who had patience. King David of ancient Israel became king after the death of King Saul. We're going to look ahead to 2 Samuel in chapter 16. And years later, when King David's son Absalom rebelled against King David, and Absalom set himself up as king over Israel, there was an interesting happening that showed how magnanimous to bear sufferings with fortitude and patience that explained some of the character of King David. So 2 Samuel 16 and verse 5. Now when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. Now, I might add, you see, David followed Saul as the king. So here's a relative of King Saul. He came out, meaning Shimei, came out cursing continuously as he came. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men that were on his right hand and on his left. Now, I want to explain what was the likely circumstance that King David was walking down the bottom of a ravine or a small valley. And he had his men on the right, his men on the left, presumably in front of him and behind him, and his group was moving down, and the Shimei was walking up on the ridge. And he was shouting down, and you know how you can create an echo by calling in such place. They could hear him well. So Shimei's up there and saying things. What does he say? He came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right and his left. And also Shimei said this when he cursed, "Come out, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue." Could be that the King James interpreters toned down some of the sauciness, because they did call it cursing. "The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul." In other words, this is your problem, this is your trouble. "In whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. So now you're caught in your own evil, because you are a bloodthirsty man." Well, this guy wasn't very respectful of King David. So what do we read then in verse 9, 2 Samuel 16 and verse 9? "Then Abishai the son of Zeruiah said to the king, 'Why should this dead dog curse the Lord my king?'" Why would they call him a dead dog? Well, first of all, dog is unclean. And dead because when you do something like that to the king, you're as good as dead. It's just a matter of time. You just don't curse the king like that. And so they said, "Why should this dead dog curse the Lord my king? Please let me go over and take off his head." Now, these are mighty men. It wouldn't take much. They could scramble up. One or two or a few of them could scramble up. And Shimei couldn't get away. And verse 10, "But the king said, 'What have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah? Let him curse, because the Lord has said to him,'" perhaps the Lord, and it could be perhaps the Lord has said to him, "'curse David, and then who shall say, why have you done so?' And David said to Abishai and all his servants, 'See how my son who came from my own body seeks my life. How much more may now this Benjamite,'" meaning seek my life, "'let him alone, let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. May it be that the Lord will look upon my affliction, and the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day.'" In other words, we don't know why this guy is doing it. I mean, he's from the house of Saul. Just let it go. You know, it's not worth it to go scrambling off to chase every offense. And verse 13, "And as David and his men went along the road," now you can imagine this, he's down in a ravine or a valley, "Shimei went along the hillside and cursed as he went, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust." And I put in my own notes, "like a bull in a bull ring," and maybe you've seen that. Kicking up the dust, you know, showing off. "Oh boy, what I'm going to do to you, just come on up here," and throw rocks at him. Well, how patient are we with happenings in life? Are we able to go about like King David when he essentially pardoned Shimei and just let some things go? Are we more like the sons of Zeruiah, looking for the next enemy to execute? Are we able to smooth things over? Are we working to develop the skill set that allows us to smooth things over? What if the problem that we're facing isn't even our fault? Do we have to be gracious or magnanimous then? In 1 Peter 2, in verse 20, in 1 Peter 2:20, "For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God." There's an interesting article that was in an online magazine this week, written by Kevin DeYoung, entitled "A Case for Christian Magnanimity." It was written 3 days ago, around Thanksgiving time, because being magnanimous fits in together with being thankful. Those are sister subjects. And he writes, and I will quote briefly from his article, "The magnanimous person is one who does not bear petty grudges, does not wallow in self-pity, does not demand penance," meaning payment, "does not advertise his suffering, does not stoop to settle every score. In an age where everyone is scrambling to be more aggrieved than everyone else," everybody wants to be a victim, right? "When we think of nothing of retweeting praise and retweeting insults to prove our aggrieved status, where apologies are routinely demanded and offendedness is next to godliness, surely we have much to learn about magnanimity." Well, I think he's really hitting on something here. It says, everybody's walking around ready to be offended at the drop of a hat. And then apologies are demanded. And if you're a victim, well, then that's next to godliness, is what he's writing. Well, that's what people have. And so they go around with a chip on their shoulder, not understanding what magnanimity is about. He continues, "Being magnanimous is not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. While we certainly want to stand up to real physical violence and insist all the rights according to us by God and by the laws of the land, when it comes to insults, rudeness, and social media scrappiness, killing them with kindness is usually the way to go." So somebody has it figured out. Just kill them with kindness. Be nice. "I understand," he writes, "that there's a time to fight and a time to stand your ground, a time to give as good as you get. Most of us, most of the time, would be well to minimize our own offendedness and praise what we can, even in those who oppose us." You know, we could define magnanimity as being gracious under challenging circumstances. That's probably the easiest understanding we have, being gracious under challenging circumstances. We live in a world that isn't particularly gracious. Our task is to demonstrate graciousness or magnanimity that the world sorely needs, but it doesn't display it very often. It's our task to bear one another's burdens, avoid meanness, and set up an example of noble generosity that we read about in Merriam-Webster's dictionary. Being magnanimous doesn't mean rolling over and playing dead under every circumstance. Certainly Jesus Christ established limits and held firm to those limits. We read twice that Jesus twice sent the money changers out of the temple. We read of the patriarch Abraham, who gathered up 318 of his own armed horsemen and chased the five kings who had kidnapped Abraham's nephew Lot. He didn't say, "Oh, well, I might have other nephews somewhere. I guess we get some, we lose some, right? That wasn't a call for graciousness there. And as the writer that we read earlier, Mr. DeYoung, points out, being magnanimous is simply not the way to win friends and influence people. That's not all there is to it. I'll paraphrase his expression. Being magnanimous or gracious is the Christian thing to do. In Luke 23, verse 34, Jesus said, and there he is being tortured to death, and Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." What an example for us. Now, there are benefits to being gracious or magnanimous, because if we aren't gracious, then we tend to be angry. An interesting study was pointed out, I have here, by a Dr. Cynthia Faik, who's a cardiologist, and wrote the following summary in an article from one of her books: "Toxic emotions can lead to health problems." Anger and hatred are natural, but they're also some of the most toxic emotions we can have. Feelings of rage and hatred build up in the mind, body, and soul, afflicting one's organs and natural processes and breeding even more negative emotions. Expressing anger in reasonable ways can be healthy, but explosive people who hurl objects and yell at others frequently may be at greater risk for heart disease. Prolonged bouts of anger can take the toll on the body in the form of high blood pressure, stress, anxiety, headaches, and poor circulation. Research shows that even 1 5-minute episode of anger is so stressful it can impair your immune system for more than 6 hours. All of these health issues can lead to more serious problems such as heart attacks and stroke. In contrast, 1 minute of laughter boosts the immune system for 24 hours. What a difference. So displaying patience in the face of suffering, as we read in Galatians 5:22, and you've read it yourself, is a fruit of the Spirit. So the point five is the definition of magnanimity, to bear sufferings with fortitude and patience. Over 240 years ago, Mr. Witherspoon described magnanimity in 5 ways: to attempt great and difficult things, to aspire after great and valuable possessions, to encounter dangers with resolution, to struggle against difficulties with perseverance, and to bear sufferings with fortitude and patience. We often refer to this last definition as graciousness. So let's each do our part to demonstrate we're a Christian by being magnanimous, by showing love, that outgoing concern for others. Let us all be gracious.